And the tape can start. This is a forum on making connections between the church locally and the church globally. I think biblically the understanding of the church is various, but primarily the church is seen in the New Testament as in one place, localized, or as a universal community. The Bible doesn't know much about national churches, the way we tend to organize denominations today according to national boundaries. That's really not known in the biblical record. The other introductory thing I want to say is that there's a sense in the scriptures of all of us being interconnected. St. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, in the famous passage about the body and the members of the body. But God has so composed the body, and for body we can read the church, the body of the church. He's using the analogy of the human body. God has so composed that body, giving the greater honor to the inferior part, that there may be no discord in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. That may be serve as a kind of a theme verse for our discussion tonight about our interconnectedness with all who name the name of Jesus. So we're going to talk about the local global connection. I have the view that unless something happens in the church locally, where I am a member, the congregation of which I am a member, it doesn't really happen for me. It may be happening somewhere in Tanzania or Namibia or El Salvador, but unless it happens in my congregation, I have a very hard time relating to it. And I think that's true for most Christians in our time. So we've got a panel of three who are going to help lead us into the subject matter, and then we hope all of you will join in the discussion for the bulk of our hour together. Leading off, Carol Berkland, who's here on my left. Carol, some of you have met already this week. She has been doing a series here on the Middle East. She works for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in the Chicago office. And relates to, on behalf of the Global Mission Unit of that church body, relates to the Middle East and East Africa. She doesn't spend all her time in Chicago, however. She travels quite a bit in those parts of the world. And has a long record, in particular, of spending time in the Middle East in a variety of roles. She has also done some special study at the Ecumenical Institute in Basse, near Geneva in Switzerland. And through that experience and others brings a kind of ecumenical view to this globalism that we're going to talk about. Secondly, Vicki Schmidt on my right, who comes from Bemidji, Minnesota, is the stateside coordinator of something called Sister Parish, which is an effort to link congregations in North America with congregations in other parts of the world, primarily at this point Central America, though it's branching out into the Caribbean and other places as well. And Vicki will tell you about that as one model for linking local communities of believers in various parts of the world. And finally, Rolf Olson, who is here, is from Duluth, Minnesota, where he is one of the pastors at First Lutheran Church. And Rolf will talk about experiences in that congregation and elsewhere about things that work and things that don't work in trying to make the global connection for people in local communities of Christians. So Carol, you're on first, and then we'll go with Vicki and Rolf subsequently.
From my experience, which has now been near 9 years of working with certainly the Lutheran Church in the United States and also with overseas Lutheran churches, now for the last year and a half in Africa and the Middle East, it's become obvious to me that there's a tremendous amount of desire within the American church and certainly within the overseas churches to make human connections. It's almost, when I think of the words from the hymn of Mystic Sweet Communion, there's something in us that we can't even articulate as Christians that makes us want to make connections with other Christians. And that's as it should be, because I don't believe we, certainly in the United States, have really understood the fact that Christianity is a world religion. We talk about Islam being a world religion, but I don't think we've ever taken the fact seriously that Christianity is a world religion as well. And what goes along with that, of course, is that if we say that it is a world religion, we also have to then admit that we are not the center of it, that there are many different centers of it, and we are a part of that. I think, from a personal point of view, I find the relationship with Christians from other cultures to be extremely stimulating. Sometimes I sit in church and, you know, we say the same liturgies over and over every Sunday, and sometimes I wonder if we even understand what we're saying anymore. We need to have relationships with our brothers and sisters overseas who somehow worship differently than we do. And maybe they see things in the scriptures, they read the Bible with different eyes. And we just need this stimulation above and beyond what I talked before about the personal desire to make connections. However, this kind of connection is a great challenge to us simply because of certain manifestations of our own culture. If we say we are really interested in making connections and having an international dimension to our lives as Christians, then we must be willing to receive. And we have not been very willing to receive in the past. We must be willing to understand that we need to receive, that we are, in a sense, today, the needy ones. I think we are needy ones in a spiritual sense and in other senses as well.
As American Christians.
Yes, yeah. Right.
We are in need.
And I remember there's this great quote from an individual who used to be one of the bishops in Tanzania who talked about the new pagans. From his point of view, from a lot of African points of view, there is a pagan community, and that's the community that exists in Europe and the United States. And a lot of Africans feel very duty-bound to, in a sense, bring the gospel anew to us. So it goes full circle. We brought the gospel to them when, in a sense, they were the needy ones. Now, in a sense, we're the needy ones, and they feel a very, very much a responsibility to, in a way, re-evangelize. They use that that term. It causes a problem for us. It causes a problem for me as a church bureaucrat, in the sense that I work with, for example, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania, which is a huge church, about 1.3 million members. And that church is a result of mission work from America, from Scandinavia, from Germany, and there are now in the ELCT about 16 synods and dioceses. And that church right now is really trying to make itself into one unified church. But there are conflicting personalities and a lot of different needs that come up within each one of those 16 churches or 16 dioceses. And while we have maybe a rather romantic vision of what overseas churches are like, they are, in a sense, you know, I hate to use the word, but it's true, bedeviled by the same things that bother us. It's like, you know, we have some very strong synods. The strength traditionally has been up there in the upper Midwest, where the needy synods will be in a place like Arizona, or let's say Florida, where Lutheranism is not particularly strong. And believe me, those bishops and those synod structures fight with each other to get everything they can in terms of projects and scholarships and whatever. And what I, as the church official who represents the American church, I deal with my counterpart, who in this case is the general secretary of the Tanzanian church, and he's trying to see that nobody gets more than anybody else to try to mold this church into one unit. And I run into problems when I get very well-meaning people who have a lot of energy and a lot of good intentions, but they call me up on the phone and they say they want to give such and such to that place. And not only do they want to give it there, do they tell me what they want to give, they tell me how they want to give it, and they never once take into consideration the fact that maybe that overseas church knows what they need better than we do. It's a real difficult problem. I had a huge argument with, well, it was one argument. I tried not to argue with him. I tried to be as nice as I could. But some guy who called me up, and he had $5,000, and he wanted to give it to a certain, it was to be for a certain agricultural development project. And I said, but sir, this project is not even on the approved list of projects that have come from the Tanzanian church. Have a little respect. Again, it's this idea that we in the United States are the generous ones. We can solve all problems by giving money. And not only can we solve all problems by giving money, but we can even tell the other church how we can solve their problems. We're not even willing to listen to what they say they need from us. So that's a real problem. Again, I think in the national church right now, we are certainly we need money and we need funds for scholarships and we need funds for projects, but those are the kinds of projects that our partners define. We don't want to tell them what we think they need. So in a sense, it means we have to go through a bureaucratic structure, and right now there's a lot of mistrust about bureaucratic structures in the new church, but in the end, I think that it helps if we are at least sensitive to those kinds of things. I'll end with a wonderful quote that I think kind of describes my idea about interdependence. It's from a Nigerian author named Chinua Achebe, who has written his latest book is Ant Hills of the Savannah, in which he says, whatever you are is never enough. You must find a way to accept something, however small, from the other to make you whole and to save you from the mortal sin of righteousness and extremism. And that's one thing we Americans have never been very willing to understand or accept, is that we see ourselves as a totality, and that in a sense, we really are not, and we need other people.
Thank you, Carol. Vicki, tell us about Sister Parish as one approach to this linkage with Christians in other parts of the world.
Well, Sister Parish, and the reason I'm here talking about it is a direct result of my own personal experience in other countries. Having gone through countries of Africa earlier in my life, and then in the 80s beginning some travel in Central America, I went as one who was ready to give, and had a real turning around in my own thinking that really fits with what Carol's been talking about. Went with full hands and full hearts, knowing I had gifts to give, but forgetting that those people with whom I was living and working indeed had gifts too. And when I began to be emptied of my own and be able to receive theirs, then that conversion process started happening. In 84 was my first experience in Central America, and that's where a lot of my earlier experiences kind of came together. I'd spent time in South Africa and Ethiopia and Hong Kong and some of the other parts of the world where these things started happening, but something happened there, I guess, that took me over the edge. Maybe being with the base Christian community people and really, really for the first time receiving. And it was out of that encounter that I began to do a lot more reading, a lot more visiting with people like Carol who had that experience. And then having a drive to help other people be connected in that same way, in that way of being open with open hands to receive the gifts of the people. And I knew that it happened to me because of the personal encounter I had with the realities of folks. And what I came home with was that interest to enable other people to experience that. met someone who had also experienced the same kinds of things I had, an ELCA pastor who was planning to leave the parish ministry and move to Guatemala to work on a little concept he had, which was to just bring folks together in the same way that I was thinking. And out of the combined visions that the two of us had, we formed what we call Sister Parish. It's not a new concept. It's not new at all. It's similar to sister citying and that kind of twinning. But combined with our personal experiences, we felt that a real necessary part of what was going to happen would have to be education, you know, real in-depth study of the situation, hearing from people who had those kinds of experiences and who had really begun to receive the gifts of the people, and then to bring folks into an encounter with the realities, the political, social, religious, economic realities of each other, begin to live the life together, and then share in a partnering, not being a gringo project, not imposing on them what we thought they might need, but to hear and listen and dialogue, and then gather around a common task if that is the direction that the partnering took, but not to go with in mind to lay it on them. And so out of that work has come now what we're doing. Like you said, I'm the stateside coordinator for that project. My co-worker lives in Guatemala and really does a lot of the legwork and the work with the parishes and the communities in the areas that we're working in. We're trying to tie in as much as we can with the various divisions of the ELCA. We've made contact with Church and Society and Global Mission and are in dialogue with a number of the staff people. We're working in Latin America with CELEP, which is an organization headed by one of our ELCA missionaries, Ana de Garcia, in Costa Rica. We're working with Alphalete, which is a Methodist-based but a literization group that is working in a number of those countries in different projects. We're trying to network as much as we can with people who really understand the same kind of philosophy and want the same kind of real, true partnering to happen. We're starting what we think is relatively small. We're committed to just 6 linkages per year. But we're asking for a longer-term commitment, not just a one-shot deal, but congregations who really want to be intimate partners, so to speak, with each other. And so we begin with a 3-year commitment where people may have more than one delegation, draw more of the folks of the congregation into the total picture, keep in communication with the linked partners on a very regular basis. But you can see as the years go by and 6 happen each year, what happens as each new year is added. And it's, we find a lot of people who want to do this. Just like you said, there's a real drive for people to be connected. And I heard Bishop Chilstrom in April talk about Mission 90, where he really stated that he wants every congregation in the ELCA to be linked with another congregation somewhere in the world. I think it's a coming thing more and more as we seek to find our sisterhood and brotherhood with each other in the church, that this is something that I really see becoming more and more a part of what we are in our community.
Okay. We can ask more questions of you later about that. And I think you have some literature with you, don't you?
I have a brochure.
Rolf told me as we began that he is not feeling too well. And so if he leaves before the hour is up, it's probably not because of something you said that offended him.
I had a trip to Holden Lake today, and You're worn out.
Level. It is non-existent.
Well, if you fall asleep during your presentation, you'll understand.
Please do that. Chuck asked me, as we talked yesterday, if I would be interested in sharing with the group some of the things that we are talking about, kind of joys and trials along the road of globally involving a congregation, perhaps more along the line of mistakes I've made along the way. But he said, you have 4 minutes. And I'd take me a whole hour to describe all the mistakes that I and those that have been involved have made along the way. But perhaps what I might be able to do is give you sort of a story that pulls in some of the successes and failures and the struggles, kind of summarizes what has been, you know, a part of certainly my pastoral ministry and involvement with many wonderful people, committed people in the congregation. This is a story that comes out of my previous parish in southern Wisconsin. But after a number of years with the Church and Society Committee in our congregation, noticed that there was just an incredible abundance of poinsettias and Easter lilies that were adorning our sanctuary on holiday times. The question was raised by this group that had been in a long process of studying the root causes of hunger. We've been reading a number of pretty heavy books trying to figure out what are the root causes of hunger and what would be an appropriate response that we as North American Christians might make other than simply throwing money into the kitty, which is an appropriate response, no question about it. But one thing we discovered was that many of the ornamental flowers grown in our country are sold in our country, are grown in lands that formerly were used to grow food for people in Mexico and wherever. And we thought, you know, is there a connection here? And that combined with the fact that the Easter lilies and poinsettias were donated by, or were given by people in honor of a loved one, which is fine. $8, I think, was the fee. But then they went and picked them up afterwards and took them home. And their envelope number was listed in the form for, you know, submitting their $8. So not only were they allowed to keep the poinsettia or Easter lily, they also got a write-off.
Tax deductibility.
The secretary spent hours typing up these lists, and you've seen them, you know, given in memory of so-and-so. And perhaps those flowers were going on lands that, you know, people could use to grow food. So Church and Society Committee decided, well, maybe we ought to recommend that we limit the number of ornamental flowers that we use at holiday times. We had been having well over 100 donated to our services, and we thought, you know, maybe 25 might be adequate to adorn the altar and that sort of thing. Just kind of tossed it out. Well, I brought it up at a staff meeting that the Church and Society Committee was moving in that direction. Little did I know that there's a person on our staff, a volunteer person who was at the staff meeting, who was on this committee that decorated the sanctuary. And she got up during the middle of this meeting, and before it was over, she was on the line with all these ladies that were part of a pretty powerful group in the congregation that decorated the altar and had, you know, phone lines going, and before that meeting was over, I mean, boy, it was all over town. And so, I mean, you know, I didn't think anything of it. The staff said, great idea, you know, that's crazy. Why can't we give them to the shut-ins or do something, you know, with these to bring the joy of Easter and Christmas outside of the group? Well, I don't know what it was. A few days later, I got a phone call from one of these ladies saying, what are you doing wrecking Christmas for us? And, she was just, flew off the handle. And I said, well, we haven't done anything yet. It's just kind of in the discussion stage. We'll probably bring it up at church council. We haven't even formally written out a recommendation. Yeah, well, you know, times are tough, and we need all the glory and joy and the sanctuary. And I went through this whole thing, well, you know, could we give them to shut-ins at $8? We could offer an alternative, giving it to hunger. We could limit the number. Possibly those flowers, we need to research it, but possibly those flowers are grown, you know, et cetera. Well, that didn't fly very well. But to summarize the process, I'm probably up to about 3 minutes now. We did present it to the church council in a slightly modified fashion in discussion with these ladies and rather heated conversations. I mean, basically, he coming at me and me just trying to survive the onslaught. We agreed that we would limit it to, limit the number of points that is, and Easter lilies to the number of shut-ins that we had. And that the shut-ins would receive them then as a, you know, a gift of the church at the holiday times. And that people would be given the option of giving to World Hunger, the Hunger World Hunger Program of the Lutheran Church. But I learned a lot in that experience, and three things I just want to share. One is that I think the process of involving the congregation in global issues, justice issues, is as important as the is almost as important as the final product. You know, and Chuck read that passage from 1 Corinthians 12 about we're all a part of the body of Christ. If I were to do that over again, and that's not an issue in my present parish, they have basically the same program. And by the way, that previous parish now, 4 years later, is still doing what we agreed on back then. So the process finally did work. But I should have gone to those ladies, or the Church and Society Committee people should have gone to those ladies and discussed with them first, which we may yet have had, may yet have done, had not this person on our staff meeting got out and, you know, short-circuited the whole process. But I have found over the years that it is helpful to discuss with the particular people involved, those who might most directly be upset about some effort that we want to begin, to get into a process of discussion with them instead of just, you know, galloping in on your white horse and saying we're going to do global awareness or something. The second thing I learned from that is that we need to watch the symbols that we're tinkering with in the parish. I mean, those poinsettias and Easter lilies were powerful symbols of tradition and security, and we were messing around with some pretty sacred things. I mean, I didn't realize how sacred they were. But we need to be aware of that. I heard another story today about somebody who was tinkering around with coffee hour and the serving of cookies, and that they wanted to do a hunger awareness coffee hour.
Here?
Shirley Wuchter was telling us about that. And boy, I mean, those cookies became an incredible symbol of, I mean, it's like poinsettias. You know, people latch onto these things. So we need to watch the symbols when we're tinkering with some of these things. And thirdly, I think I was able to survive that relatively unscathed in this situation and in other situations that I've dealt with, because as a parish pastor, I have learned that if we can keep a solid core of accepted functions rolling, such as solid worship, solid pastoral care, solid Sunday school programs, you can mess around with a lot of these other things, and people aren't going to get too bent out of shape as long as some of these things are kept in line. But if you know, are going to have a hunger awareness worship service and spring that on people with some sort of, you know, not very adequate process of dialogue beforehand, you're really going to have problems. But if we remember that the process is very important, the symbols need to be dealt with pretty well, need to be dealt with sympathetically, and keeping these solid core functions going, we can mess around with a lot of these things and make mistakes, but survive and carry on.
Thank you. Okay, I'd invite those of you who are present to share experiences you've had with trying to do global-local connecting in your parishes, and you know, both failures as well as successes. And also, if you want to ask questions of any of the panelists, that would be appropriate as well. So, yes.
Well, our church, Lutheran Church of the Cross in Berkeley, we've been involved for some time with the Makomira Seminary
in Tanzania.
Tanzania, Howard Olson?
Yes.
He's retired now.
He's retired, yes.
He used to come in and...
How are you involved with that seminary?
Well, been sending him money for many years, and my little... I collect film cans, empty film cans, and they use them to fill up medicines and medicine bottles. They can't get medicine bottles there.
Oh.
We just air freight film cans to them. They're for nothing, you know. But we've also associated with, through the mission, with a Reverend Dale at seminary in Tokyo. I forget the name of the seminary. But just one thought, some mad thought came to me about Chilstrom's idea of matching up every congregation with some other congregation and knowing how things work in our system here. This sounds to me like and the amount of junk mail I get from Christian organizations, it sounds like a worst case scenario for a Dr. Strangelovian international Christian computer list for junk mail. A never ending source of this. And somehow I think, not that that would happen, but that's a worst case scenario which seems to be happening all too often with interconnected Christian organizations, which end up going independent and bugging you ad infinitum for another $10.
You have a comment on that, Carol?
Yeah, well, first thing I would like to say about the Macamira thing, I think that's really good. I'm glad to hear that. Macamira Seminary is really quite an extraordinary place, and they're very understanding of the need for interdependence. They have said now as they have more Tanzanians who can come and serve on the staff, and people who most of them, frankly, have gotten their second degrees in theology through scholarships through the ELCA, that even, they said, I wish more American seminaries would say this, they said, even if we had plenty of Tanzanians, if we had PhDs in New Testament and systematic theology and Old Testament, if we had totally enough Tanzanians to comprise the Tanzanian faculty of that seminary, we would want to have Americans, we would want to have Europeans, because again, they bring this interdependence, they bring a life to our seminary.
Enrichment
of different contextual theologies, whatever. And I mean, here is a, in a sense, a third world seminary that takes that much more seriously than Luther Seminary does, much more seriously than most of our seminaries. But the other thing I have to tell you too, which reflects the current situation, is I am absolutely heartsick because I don't think we'll have enough money to replace Howard Olson. He is retired. And there's no money to. We have been fighting, Dan Olson and I, who share Tanzania now. I'll have it all to myself starting in January. Have been that job has gone on and off the list of possibilities for the last 3 or 4 months, and I'm afraid it's off. It's off
for
the list
American
now.
To fill his position.
Yes, yeah. We've got plenty
of
people
to fund it to provide the funding.
Right, but there's no money. There's no money from the
personnel are available, but it's
the personnel are available, but there's no money to fund it.
Carol, I have a thought about a related matter, and that's the exchange of clergy.
Mm-hmm.
One way the gift of Christians in other parts of the world can come to us is through personnel who come to us. And I know some of that's done, but what do you see as the future of that? Is that growing? Should it be growing? Should there be more such opportunities? What about the impoverishing of the church from which they come, which doesn't have enough people? Address that, would you?
Well, most of the, certainly the churches that I deal with say, yes, we might have a clergy shortage. That's not so much in Tanzania anymore. There are a lot of good people coming out of the seminaries. But they feel, again, it's their responsibility to come and, in a sense, be missionaries to us, so they take that very seriously. And one of the things that we hope will happen, we already have the program now, is what's called the exchange program. It's really not an exchange because we very seldom send American pastors
there
simply because the American pastors could not live in the circumstances that they would have to live out in the bush. They couldn't do it. But we've had, that was one of the things that I did in the old ALC that, sure, we had some problems, you know, every once in a while situation didn't work out, but by and large, we had extraordinary experiences of Tanzanians, and because of the language problem, because they have to speak English, we would have Papua New Guinea, Tanzania, Nigeria, South Africa, and these pastors would come and spend 9 months in a congregation, usually three periods of 3 months. They'd move to three different congregations, and one I remember most well is remained a good friend of mine, a very tall, wonderful fellow by the name of Pastor Danuwonosiku from Nigeria, who who went to the campus ministry at the University of North Dakota, I guess in Grand Forks, or is it Bismarck?
Grand Forks.
And he worked there as just a regular part of the campus ministry staff, only he happened to be a Nigerian Lutheran. And one of the things he did was go and visit old folks' home. You just kind of go and pray with the people and visit them, or also hospital chaplaincy. And he told me a story about, and I can't imagine it, but it's quite amazing, of going into this room. He would look at the list of patients in the hospital and who's getting visitors and who wasn't. And there was this very aged lady who wasn't getting any visitors. So he decided he would visit her one day. And can you imagine the expression on her face when her hospital door opened and here stood 6'2" Dena Wunosiku from Nigeria wearing a clergy collar who had come to visit her that day, and she was just astonished. And I asked
him. There's not much of a black community in Grand Forks.
No, there's not much black community. And the last thing she expected to come through the door that day was a Nigerian pastor to come, Lutheran pastor to come and visit her. But to make a long story short, they established an incredibly close relationship. And the Nigerians and a lot of Africans have a very personal way of praying and a kind of piety that is really lovely. It's not naive at all, but it's very honest and it's very moving. And the relationship between those two was made that will never, I mean, that woman's life was changed forever because of that encounter. And she would never, of course, have met a Nigerian Lutheran pastor if it hadn't been for that program. So that program still exists. I mean, if any congregation is interested in hosting one of those pastors, we can make the arrangements. And that will be, I think...
They can contact you or ELCA Global Mission.
Global Mission Division. And now, as Bishop Chilstrom has talked very seriously about this companion church program, he's very serious about it. So I am convinced that that will be one of the major components. Sometimes it frightens me, you know, when I think of, we're talking about a huge number of American parishes who are going to want pastors. Well,
potentially 11,000 linkages.
Yes. It's just overwhelming.
It would be a computer bureaucratic nightmare.
Right.
Yes.
To manage it.
But in that sense, it would be contained within the church. I mean, we're not going to go out raising money. That money would come in through the general budget of the church to pay for those programs. And the thing is that we're finding is that churches are, they've got the money, but they're more willing to give to something that they have more ownership of in relation to than certainly a program that comes from us. Mm-hmm.
So. Who else would like to get in here?
Sure.
Yes, go ahead.
I think one of the things that I've had most success with is music from other cultures and doing that. And people are often surprised to find that the music from third world countries has a real sense of joy and wonder about it. And I was really pleased to see in the bookstore here the songs of protest and praise from South Africa, because those particular songs I've used in a number of congregations now. And people love them and want to know more about South Africa. It's very accessible music for people, but I've also done that with a lot of Central American music as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's real simple. You know, you can even do such a seemingly simple thing as every year, at least the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA prints what's called a missionary prayer calendar, which has all the pictures of the missionaries who serve overseas and all the names of the overseas church leaders and whatever. And it's just a very simple thing in the prayer for the church every Sunday to add an international dimension to your worship, to include those people, to pray for them.
That reminds me of a very excellent collection of prayers that the World Council of Churches produced. Right. Do you remember the name of it?
Ecumenical Prayer Cycle, isn't it?
The one I'm thinking of has another name. It's something like For All the People or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it has by weeks areas of the world and the churches of those areas of the world. It's ecumenical. It's Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, whatever. And a little bit of description about the church and churches in that country or that region. And then prayers that come from that and those churches.
And we used those 1 year in our congregation in Minneapolis, and it was very meaningful in the prayer time. And every Sunday, a different part of the world was featured that way. Yes?
I was wondering, Vicki, when you talk about matching up like a sister congregation, what kind of relationship do they have?
What do they do
what
together?
What kind of things do they do? Yeah, I was asking.
Did you all hear that? She's asking when a congregation is linked with another parish, what kinds of things do they do in the relationship?
Yeah, like,
okay. These linkages are developing that I'm working with, and those answers aren't all in yet. But as a for instance, I went with a delegation in March to Guatemala, and the linkages as they're developed are all a little bit different from each other. This happens to be our synod, together with a diocese, a comparable geographical level, that is linking with a large squatter settlement. So it's more geographical. It's the squatter settlement outside Guatemala City where my co-worker lives and works with his wife. And a small group of people within that squatter settlement have been struggling with some of the health care issues in that community. And they are not an organized group of people. They're people who come from the hills, who've been terrorized or have fled from their villages and come together from a number of different tribes and different locations, so they don't know each other. They have different languages even. So it's a very, different variety of people that are there. And because of that, they have not come together in much sense of organization. But they know that some of the needs that they have include that there's just no dental care there at all, and there's very little health care. And they have expressed an interest in getting education about health care promotion and dental care promotion. And what they have asked the linked group to do is to walk with them in that process. So some of the things we did in the delegation when the delegation was there, was to go with the people from the consejo or the directive group of the community to a number of health care and dental care facilities, meet with some of the health care promoters and visit with them about what that would mean for them. And they began to get a sense of what they wanted. There was no money. We didn't come and give them money to start a dental or health care clinic, but you know, support them in, you know, kind of be cheerleaders actually at that point. And we did that for about 10 days with them, and at the end when we did some evaluating together, they said, we weren't sure when you came here what you were going to do to us.
To us.
that's how they said it. Yeah. At least that's how it was translated. Usually when Americans come, they bring their dollars and they leave them and they go home and we never hear from them again.
Is that true?
And that particular community, Mezquital, gets a lot of groups through there. Weekly, if not sometimes almost every other day. But we were surprised when you said you weren't here to bring us money, but that you were here to be our friends. But that's what we want from you. We'll let you know when we need the dollars. And maybe someday, you know, that will be part of what we'll do. We may raise money, or we will work with them in building what they need. But at this point in time in the relationship, we're walking with them as they discover for themselves what they need. We even had put a dentist in the group who was just raring to bring stuff. You know, I can get a dental chair, I can get the tools. Just wait, Betsy, just wait, you know? And, you know, what happened to her down there was so phenomenal. It was just the kind of thing you hope happens. You know, she said, I'll wait till they tell me what I can do, and I don't need to send the dental chair. They can buy that right there. That's not the issue. It's not the dental chair, but the support. And that's the kind of relational thing that we really want to happen.
Vicki, a sister parish pairing typically begins with a visit of about 10 days, right?
Yeah.
From a North American group to the Central American partner.
It's it's kind of happening that way, although there, like I mentioned before, we were committed to a period of study with the group, study of the overall picture of the region and specifically the area that they want to tie into. And for that, we use resources like the folks from the Center for Global Education in Minneapolis who share some of their experiences, who have a, you know, are actively working there regularly, so they have a real good picture of what's happening. People like that. We actually contract with them. And then we have also a major orientation for the folks who actually are committed to going on the first delegation. During that time, in some situations, there is some letter exchange, some photo exchanges, but it seems that what we're finding out is the face-to-face reality is what really clicks them in, and then it's their friends forever. You know, it's just, I've gotten 8 letters from Mezquital since I've come home, from little girls and older women, and, you know, just, how are you? We like you, or we love you, you know, all that stuff, and thank you for being our friends. And that's really what's happening. But we thought there would be more happening before the delegation, but it is the delegation that's really cementing the relationships.
And whether there's a return visit or not depends on each situation.
Yeah, right? I have ambivalent feelings about that as it goes along. There is something to be said about having some of those folks visit us, but economics really would dictate that that's very unlikely unless we provide the way. And secondly, what can, you know, I struggle with all our affluence, what, maybe it's almost reverse, what can they get from us? I was sort of, I really go back and forth on that. I don't know, I haven't settled that question at all.
And there have not yet been any return visits arranged, right?
Well, my coworker, who had a sister parish relationship in his previous congregation, they have had exchanges in that congregation. This was kind of the seed program from out of which our program came. But yes, there have been some there. And the people in the congregation out in Baltimore area paid for those folks, raised the money to bring them.
Are you talking about Lamai?
Pardon?
Are you talking about in Baltimore?
Actually, it was Columbia, Maryland, and Holy Comforter in Baltimore, and then Luther Place in
Richard Fenske is the pastor.
Yeah, I know Dick Fenske. But I was going to make a comment about that, what you're just raising up, because it's a real problem when you... we did bring some people up from San Juan de Lai to one congregation here, and they just flipped out. They lasted 3 days and just could not deal with it. And...
our lifestyle, our affluence, what was it?
Everything. Yeah. There were the expectation. It was not handled well. The expectations were that, you know, they would come up here and just be, you know, suddenly able to talk to all these North Americans, and they couldn't handle the numbers of people who wanted to talk to them. They couldn't handle the social expectations. People wanted to have them to dinner.
It was just intimidating, right?
Yeah, there were a lot of mistakes made by the committee in Baltimore. But
this Casa Baltimore?
Yeah.
With Mitchell's?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I heard all about that.
Right. Yeah, it was not good. But anyhow, I'm curious to know if somebody has managed to pull it off. But since I was involved with Casa Baltimore at the time, it was a real painful kind of experience.
Yeah, sounds like
we have a lot to learn about how to do that.
They just said, you know, we have to go home. Mm-hmm. They just put their foot down and they were on the next flight about.
Yes.
Will this include, I was thinking Estonia, Latvia, East Germany, Poland, Hungary?
There have been, through Lutheran World Federation, some linkages of Lutheran congregations here with Lutherans in Eastern Europe that I'm aware of. I don't think numerically it has ever become very big, but there were those possibilities back in the earlier 80s.
I'm just thinking of the sort
but
of the,
through Sister
the
Parish.
Changes now that are going on over there, if they're opening up the doors, it might be a chance for us to walk through it.
I think there are some doors opening for that. I don't know who's working on it. Do you, Carol?
Well, I know certainly in the the sister parish or whatever we're going to call it, I don't think it has a name yet, that in the beginning we will concentrate on those areas where there are Lutheran partner churches with whom we have close relationships already, so we can build on the structures that are already in place. And a lot of that involves missionary personnel as well. I'm not saying that Eastern Europe won't be a part of it, because we have a secretary for Europe. I mean, I'm from Africa, but we have David Nelson, who's secretary for Europe. So that'll be a possibility. And also one of the things we've had extremely good luck with is bringing every year an overseas church person to be on the campus ministry staff at St. Olaf College. We started off with a South African who was just, the impact that man had on the St. Olaf campus was just incredible. Since that time, they've had an Ethiopian, they had a Latin American, Brazilian, I believe, last year. This year, they're having someone from either East Germany or, I think it's East Germany. So,
Lutheran Peace Fellowship is doing some sistering in East Germany. I don't know if they're going over the boundaries into those countries, but do you know?
No, I don't know, but is Anne Hampton here? No.
Sister Parish, thus far, has been primarily Lutherans here with non-Lutherans in Central America, right? But
yeah.
Largely because there aren't many Lutherans in Central America. It's been Roman Catholics predominantly and some Anglicans?
Some Anglican, working with a Baptist group in Nicaragua. And we're working with other than Lutheran congregations in the States, too.
Mm, okay.
Actually, we figured out we've been in contact with 14 different denominations, primarily because it's Minnesota and Lutherans. We end up with a heavy on the Lutherans, but our concentration of the board members now is to have a wider representative board, also including people of color and people of. We have people who are Catholic, Lutheran, Methodists now, and we're not totally Lutheran. We are really striving for ecumenicity.
I got it out too.
Ecumenicity.
Well, from what Vicki has said, that just sounds like an extraordinarily good program. It's exactly right in terms of its kind of sitting back and waiting. Not coming in with the big bunches of money. I think, frankly, that's the thing I most worry about in this large program.
Easiest thing for us to do is to give money.
We don't have to invest very much time. We don't have to, it's a very kind of typical American response. And in the end, it can cause, the thing we also have to understand is that if you're really a friend of a person, if you really want to be in a relationship with that person, what you don't want to do is do things that breed dependency in that person. Mm-hmm. Because, the sister church relationship is fine, but those people have to continue living in their context every day of the year. And we don't want to do anything that would introduce something into their lives that would be a burden for them to then have to support. They know how to deal with their situation best. And a lot of and these people are extremely, when you've gotten to know them, they are extremely clever in coming up with the most practical solutions for their problems that don't cost a lot of money, that they'll be able to perpetuate. It's not something we sometimes have, there are all these stories of Western aid agencies coming into Africa and saying, oh boy, what you need here is a tractor. Well, of course you don't need a tractor, because a tractor breaks down and you can't repair it, you can't get parts, and so there are these rusting hulks of machinery littering the landscape all over Africa. If someone had just asked those people what they really needed, perhaps what could have been supplied would have been something much more simple and long-lasting.
There's a great story that I love, and I share this with groups. The story of a group that was linking with a community in Nicaragua, and they said, we want to do something for you. And they said, well, we've decided that what we really need is a soccer field. And the Americans thought, that's not what they need. They need schools and dental clinics and healthcare facilities, and why would we want to give them a soccer field? Well, they struggled with that. They thought, well, this is what, you know, we're supposed to do is do what they want to do, so soccer field it is. And as the story went on, what happened was the community started gathering around this soccer field and made this recreational area for the kids and the community. The community started coming together as a community, and the downrange effect of all that was that some healthcare stuff started happening, some water supply systems started developing, but the soccer field was what they felt they needed at that time, and that was what really began the work that out of that, out of that came these other things that we thought they needed. But they weren't ready for that, you know. The community organization is what brought about all the other stuff.
Vicki, do you have some brochures you can send around for people who want them?
Yeah, or I'll leave them.
Or leave them here and you can pick them up before you leave. Yes.
Yeah. One thing that we haven't seen happening very much in our church and we feel has been really worthwhile is Mennonite Central Committee. Some of the type of work they're doing, they send out all ages, but primarily young people in a Peace Corps type of setting.
Right.
And I believe that the kids and the people who have worked for MCC who come back into the church are doing the best job of bringing the global church to the local church that you could ever find, because these kids come back with a vision. They take older volunteers too, they have something like 2,000 of these MCC volunteers throughout the world as compared to our small number of missionaries, and they got mission boards besides. Yeah. You know,
it's one of the best opportunities, and I often referred people to Mennonite Central Committee when I was working for a National Lutheran structure, because Lutheran World Relief and Lutheran World Mission Boards just didn't have the opportunities that MCC has for numbers of placements. We do a little bit of it, don't we, Carol? But
we
nothing like the scale of Mennonite Central Committee. They do it very well.
I believe that their numbers consist of 40% Lutherans.
Is that right?
Right now.
Is it that high or am I?
We've got a daughter who's with them right now in West
it's
Africa.
It's typically a two-year placement.
3 years.
3 years now, and a lot of good briefing and preparation and follow-up after they return. Mm-hmm. It's a very sophisticated program.
What I think is exciting is what I see in their church as a result of what has happened with these volunteers is because their people are so alive to missions. They have fundraisers where they raise $50,000 in a day. You know, for some of their overseas projects for MCC.
Yeah. And it's not limited to young people, as you said. They take midlife people who want a career change, and they take retired people. Anybody upstairs who wants to get in here? Others here? Any of you? Yeah.
Two comments. One was what Carol was saying about the dependency. When I traveled with Witness for Peace, they really, when we went out into the countryside and spent time staying with people, and they sort of sought out the poorest of the poor for us to stay with, they were really adamant that we not take any sort of gifts except little trinkets and treasures. And it really worked. I mean, Witness for Peace has been enormously successful. And I think largely because it's based on relationships as opposed to material aid. But I was also going to say, in response to what she said much earlier, that I think a lot of things that can happen in congregations from a clergy point of view happen if the trust is really built up. And the things that we're supposed to be doing as ministers are done, then you can do a lot of other things on top of that. That grounding is real.
Peter.
I'm glad that Rolf is here and mentioned some real practical and in some ways, small things that happen on a parish level, because I think we have to keep ringing that bell, and we who are real committed to that area, you know, it can get real overwhelming to think of these huge global issues, and if it can be, if it can get overwhelming for us, it certainly gets overwhelming for a lot of people in our parishes. And so it's okay to always think small. You know, sometimes the word is think big, but sometimes the word is think small. Think of one little thing to do, because that's important that we do those early steps, and that sometimes even the misguided responses can be mature. Somebody that, you know, don't you just hate it when people come to you at Thanksgiving, give me a needy family, I want to help them out. I just hate that, and yet there is something good about that impulse too, and how can we shape that?
Yeah.
That is like my son learning to play the violin, and the first time it was just awful, you know, he just couldn't stand it. Now he plays very well. So you got to accept those awful notes of social justice and try to coach them into something more mature than that. And
start with where people are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One, if, are we running out of time?
Well, as long as you're still awake, we aren't. Come on.
Okay, I'm hanging in here.
You're hanging in, yeah.
Tying in a couple thoughts here, and an issue that we're wrestling with at First Lutheran in Duluth right now, and I don't know if it's going to be in the mistake column or success column, but it's a live issue, is tying in with kind of what you're both talking about here. For years, First Lutheran has supported a missionary abroad. Currently, we are sending big bucks to support a missionary to Japan. And, you know, wonderful service that I think we're doing. And, you know, he baptizes two or three a year. I mean, it's amazing the cost of a missionary in Japan.
Don't
tell me about it. In terms of numbers of converts.
Yeah, I mean, it's
particularly nominal.
It's slow going, yeah.
Yeah.
So that has been a discussion for us too, but the evangelism board has been saying, you know, it's about time we start supporting another missionary. We're a church with a 425,000.
Oh, yes, replacement.
How about Tanzania?
Well, okay. Now this may be a part of the discussion. Last winter, they said, let's slam another 10 or 15,000 out of the budget and let's get a second missionary down there. It's about time we did that. We've been holding constant for 30 years. Fine. It didn't go through the budget committee, but we have a second mile program that is going on now to raise hunger funds and funds for a second missionary. Well, a member of our parish knows the bishop in Namibia, Dumeni, and Brooks Anderson. Some of you might know Brooks. He wrote to Dumeni back in the spring and said, do you know of possibility for sister church sort of thing going on in Namibia. Is this a possibility? Might we yoke up with our Namibian brothers and sisters in such a fashion? If so, let's give me some information and we'll begin discussing it within our parish. Next thing you knew, we got the name of a parish, the pastor to write to, the address. You are now matched with this church in Namibia. Well, we didn't know what to do with it. And the board of church and society just said, well, it's a great idea, let's go with it. So it's still kind of hanging out there. We're matched with this church in Namibia now. While, on the other hand, we have an effort to raise bucks to support a new missionary that we would send over somewhere. And Tanzania has been the focal point. Oh, let's send a missionary to Tanzania. And, I mean, they're both wonderful goals, I think, of projects. But I raised the question, and this is kind of being debated right now while I'm gone, how many of these different irons can we keep in the fire and effectively deal with in a meaningful way in the parish level? How many temple talks, how many small group meetings, how many,
communicate it with the members of the congregation.
Sure.
So yep. That it means something. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we got every project kind of sending bulletin inserts and all that, and you know, sometimes we hand out books on Sunday morning to people. And you know, what happens? They just go in the wastebasket when they get home. It's just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So I suggested, because the unified mailing came out from the ELCA suggesting responses to Namibia, one of them being scholarship fund.
Oh, boy, for a Namibian student, I tell you, you couldn't do anything any better.
And I raised that with the group that is pushing, let's send a missionary over and convert the heathen, you know. I said, perhaps we could support a scholarship fund for a Namibian student who could then maybe visit our congregation or some way and evangelize us, you know, get all that together. Well, I don't know where it went, where it is right now. That was a month ago, and we were discussing it, and I've since left. But it's an issue. We're trying to figure out how effectively to handle the, I mean, I don't know how many countries are out there, how many different mission projects, but how many can you handle effectively in a parish without just totally overwhelming people with the bigness and whatever?
I mean, I think that the answer to that is choose, you know, choose one or two things, and if possible, choose the one that will give you the human element, that will give you the chance to really make a human connection rather than simply the money connection. And I, you know, I know that Namibian scholarship program well because we work, our office works in coordination with Naomi Linnell every fall when they bring all those students. And we have heard from the colleges and universities where these kids have gone that they are some of the most incredible students that these people have ever seen. And when you think about it, you think that the ELCA is in the process of, in a sense, educating the next generation of leaders for that country. I
mean, yeah, it's not of the church alone, but of
no,
of
the government, of the nation. Yeah.
Namibia, some of you may not be aware, Namibia has no 4-year institution of higher learning. And so typically Namibians who wanted to get an education had to go to Europe or to South Africa. And more they don't want to go to South Africa.
Right.
So what are there now? About 80 in the U.S. At Lutheran colleges. Most of them, we hope, will finish 4 years and get a degree.
If there's ever any extra money lying around, scholarships for students, African students and other students are just really important, because I can see it now in the Tanzanian bishops that I work with. These are people who most of them have been trained in the United States, and it's a joy to work with them. They're super people, and I've always said that my personal philosophy of mission has been that what you do is you help those people discover what they already have within themselves. I mean, if you have some kind of belief in a theology of creation, that creation is good, that what God has made is essentially good, then we all have it. I mean, it's all there. But other people, certain circumstances have prevented them from realizing the gifts that they already have. And if you can simply go to a place or assist a person to develop, to have appreciation or develop a talent that they already have, that's the best thing you can do for a person. And then you leave them. You know, you just help them find out what's already there and help them develop it. And that's the greatest gift. I look around that meeting when I go to Tanzania and I see those African bishops, and I am, at that point, I'll be real patriotic. We were talking about patriotic. I'm just extremely proud to be a Lutheran, because I know that gift of a scholarship and that gift of an education was freely given to those people with absolutely nothing expected in return.
That's Lutheran chauvinism.
Right. That's it's Lutheran chauvinism, but I'm real proud of it.
You can be excused for some of that. Does anyone have a closing comment? Well, then I'll attempt one very quickly, and it would be this, that if we keep in mind some of the things that have been said tonight, we all need to continue in the church, in our local churches, to think globally, but we also need to find ways of doing it locally. And until that local connection is made, it's not real for people. I really believe that. And I guess the other thing has been said by many, try, it's very hard, but try to avoid being other than a peer with the people with whom we relate. It's very hard when our economic situations are so different. We need to struggle with that and not create a dependency, and try to go into it as to the degree we can manage it as equals in the gospel with fellow believers elsewhere. Vicki?
Can I just share the quote that's in our brochure?
Yeah, sure. That'd be a good closing.
This is one of my favorite quotes when I think about the kind of thing we're talking about. The Max Warren quoting from the Marinol, was in the Marinol magazine, which is a Catholic institution.
Mission magazine.
Mission magazine. Our first task in approaching another people, another culture, another religion, is to take off our shoes, for the place we are approaching is holy. Else we may find ourselves treading on someone's dreams. More serious still, we may forget that God was there before our arrival.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for that. If any of you have questions about Sister Parish or any other things you've heard about, feel free to come up and talk to the members of the panel. There are some brochures there. And thanks to all of you for coming, and thanks to the panelists.